Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Our very own Noel King, producer Noel King, you actually made it to the National Spelling Bee, right?
I did, John.
How old were you?
I was 12.
A lot of pressure?
Yeah, pressure was hardcore.
Pretty memorable experience.
It was my first time on an airplane.
Wow. Yeah. But you messed up.
The word was impune.
Impune. It was the G, right?
It was the G.
There you have it. At age 12, a little girl was attacked by a silent G, and she lived to tell the tale. When words don't fall trippingly from the tongue and instead trip you up, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everybody. It's Friday, May 30th. Adora Udoji is on assignment. Today, we want you to tell us stories of words that made a massive difference in your life. We want you to call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm serious. Words that tripped you up. Tell us about it. We even booked political strategist Joe Trippi. Kid you not. Also, the Latino showcase for the Democrats. That is Sunday's primary in Puerto Rico. Here's a word that trips up international bankers. Can you say LIBOR? Movies, the mother of all trailers, full coverage of the National Spelling Bee, and all the news. The final Democratic presidential primaries are on Tuesday, and party leaders say they're looking forward to the end of the nominating process. According to the Associated Press, Barack Obama is within 44 delegates of clinching the nomination. A massive, spectacular fire near Boston has forced 1,000 people from their homes. Flames consumed the roof of a four-story building in Peabody yesterday evening. John Croak lives in the apartment complex.
Somebody from work that was on vacation called me up and said the place was burning. And I got in my car, I rushed here, I got my cats out.
No injuries are reported, a gas leak is suspected. It's not clear how soon hundreds of children taken from a polygamist compound in Texas nearly 2 months ago will be reunited with their parents. The Texas High Court upheld an appeals court ruling that the state had failed to show sufficient evidence of abuse. David Hall is a lawyer representing some of the families.
The message from the Supreme Court to Child Protective Services is clear. Send these children home.
In another story, it may be equality, not biology, that creates a gender gap in math. A new study based on a math test given to youngsters worldwide suggests the gap is less pronounced in countries where men and women are more equal. Dreary picture for the airline industry. More a quarter of the respondents in a Travel Industry Association survey say they've skipped at least one air trip in the past year. How much does it cost the industry? $18 billion. Oil prices fell to just above $126 a barrel today in Asia. How'd I do? Anything I missed, Femi?
Nice job. There's also the story about the military hunter in Myanmar complaining that international communities aren't giving them enough aid. We'll also be talking about Trevor Graham. He's the disgraced coach of Marianne Jones, and he will be going to prison possibly for 5 years. And Diane O'Dell died this week. She lived in an iron lung. How many people live in an iron lung still in the United States?
The news headlines all hour long from Femi. Okay, back to the words that trip you up. What words trip you up? Here's an answer.
Hey, John, this is David from Putnam. Occasion, a word that always trips me up. O-C-C-A-S-S-I-O-N, I don't know.
Whether it's spelling or pronunciation or just was the word a key moment in your life that maybe you wish hadn't happened, you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Words that trip you up, like, say, nuclear, if you're George Bush.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at KnightFoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We are following politics this morning. My co-host Adore Doji is on assignment. She'll be back on Monday. The last three contests in the Democratic campaign hardly seems possible this weekend. The Democratic Party will come together and sort out what will happen with the delegates from Michigan and Florida. On Sunday, there's a primary in Puerto Rico, and on Tuesday, primaries in Montana and South Dakota. Is this drama or is it all moot? Joining us to discuss these last events in the Democratic nominating process is Joe Trippi. He's worked for everyone from Walter Mondale to John Edwards and managed Howard Dean's 2004 presidential campaign. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
I mean, this really has been a campaign for the books. As a political analyst and someone who was even involved in the Edwards campaign, what's it been like for you?
They're all strange trips. And this one's maybe been a little bit longer. I mean, 1980, when I worked for Senator Kennedy, went all the way to the convention. So in a lot of ways, this reminds me of that time. But it's been a historic year as well. I mean, you know, who would have thought that the one party would be have a fight between what would have been the first woman president and the first African American president of one of them would go all the way and win. So it's been exciting and long, but it's about to be over.
It seems to me that the headlines from this campaign, aside from the fact that we do have the first woman and the first African-American with a real shot at making it to the White House, it seems to me the headline is turnout on the part of the Democrats in the primaries and also fundraising tactics. Talk about turnout first, Joe.
Well, I mean, the turnout's been historic all the way through, including I think you'll see that in some of these contests that, you know, which pretty much don't matter or may not matter very much. But it's been that way all the way through. That, I think, it'll be a huge advantage for Democrats in the general election. There's been a lot of young people getting more involved and increased turnout pretty much across the board. And you just don't see that kind of interest or activity on the other side. Even when McCain was, you know, actually competing with Huckabee and others for the nomination, they just weren't turning out that kind of, getting an increased turnout on the other side. You don't see that kind of increased. It's actually more of a depressed turnout on the other side, which should worry Republicans going into the general election.
Talking about fundraising tactics, in some ways it seems as though the Obama campaign, with its focus on online fundraising and small donors, has really taken a page from the tactics that you and Howard Dean pioneered 4 years ago. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I think it's one of the big mistakes of the Clinton campaign. It's like two campaigns looked at 2004. The Clinton campaign seemed to think that the internet and some of the tools we use were sort of a fad, and that their top-down strategy would work like it always had. And the Obama campaign looked at it and, realizing that the tools had become a lot better, decided they could do it better than the Dean campaign had been able to do back then. And I think actually that's all the difference. It's why he's raised more money. It's why he won the caucus states, because he had so many volunteers over the net that he was able to plug into his strong paid organization. Clinton couldn't do that in those caucus states. She couldn't figure out, they didn't have a mechanism to put or the volunteers, online volunteers, to work for her. So in the Obama campaign, they actually had all these volunteers delivering them caucus victories for free, and also contributing to pay for the paid portion of Obama's caucus organization, you know, while the Clinton campaign was running out of money. So,
well, you know, it's interesting. We've cast you generously as prescient because of these fundraising and small donor tactics. But I'm wondering if even you, as recently as, say, 2 years ago, would have thought that out there in this kind of small donor fundraising, volunteer-based campaign world, that there were $200 million that were tappable, because that's what Obama seems to have raised, almost $200 million in these small donors. Did you think that much money was out there?
Yeah, actually, in the last chapter of my book, I said that that would happen. And I corrected myself about 3 years ago and said that I believed that the Democrat this time would raise about $500 million that way. I still believe that's going to happen. In the general election alone, I think Obama may raise $500 million, and because the numbers are so small. Yeah, you had 57 million people vote for John Kerry in the last election. 5 million of those people giving $100 to Barack Obama is totally conceivable.
Totally,
it would have been conceivable for Hillary Clinton as well, because the internet allows that to happen. I think it's going to happen in the general.
I want to talk with you, and actually, I guess we're going to introduce here in a moment about what's going on in Puerto Rico over the weekend. But just quickly, how has Howard Dean managed this campaign? He's the head of the DNC and has certainly been talking a lot when Hillary and Barack Obama were going at it, intensely, maybe a few weeks ago. How do you think he's handled this?
I think he's done an incredible job. I mean, I think, party chairman could have handled the Michigan and Florida thing. That happens at every, there's always in a contested race that kind of stuff, and the state parties are doing things that they shouldn't do. And, it's a tough wire to walk between the campaigns and those state organizations, state parties. But for the most part, in terms of 50-state strategy, the victories we had in 2006, the way it looks like we're on our way on the congressional side to victories at a very competitive presidential race where we're ahead. And, the one place where I think people, including myself, are surprised is that he was able to sort of stay under the fray, beneath the fray, and he was a guy who liked to walk into controversy and cause it, and did.
But Joe, he's a doctor. He's a medical doctor. I got to figure he's not used to being ignored by people he's diagnosed.
No, that's my point. I thought that was going to be very, very hard for him to do.
But he did it.
Yeah. Which I think is an amazing thing for him.
All right, well, joining us now is a reporter for the syndicated public radio show Latino USA, Carol King from San Juan, Puerto Rico. As you know, Joe, and as you, our listeners, know, the Puerto Rico Democratic primary is this weekend. 555 delegates are at stake. They're not decisive, but in many ways, this contest in San Juan, in Puerto Rico, is kind of a diorama of the Democratic Party's relationship to Latino voters. Carol, how's it going?
Well, it's actually getting pretty close to contributing to be decisive. If Barack Obama hoped to close a gap after a major poll in April by Time Magazine, which gave Hillary 51% and Obama 50% and Obama 37%. He hasn't done it because a new poll has just come out by the daily newspaper here, El Vocero, and it's now 51% to 38%. So it's still a 13% spread for Hillary.
So Hillary's going to lead. Hillary's going to win this.
But if Obama maintains that floor of 38%, that means he'll get at least 24 of the 55 pledged delegates here out of the island, which analysts are saying is more than sufficient to keep him on target for getting that nomination next week.
Well, Carol, Hillary got a bit of an endorsement from Ricky Martin here. Let's listen for just a second. What's the significance of Ricky Martin declaring that Hillary is... Hillary's Ricky Martin's candidate. How significant is that?
Well, Willie Colon is also on board with Hillary, and Hillary is extremely popular here, and I'm sure that throws more support to her. But I think that the Clinton camp is a bit worried because they have been campaigning furiously down here.
Obama's pretty good in the native language there in Puerto Rico, right?
Well, he's certainly giving that impression. He just came out with a television ad where he speaks with quite a good Spanish accent. And, in fact, I was out on the street yesterday at rush hour talking to people waiting for the bus to go home. And I found that a lot of people in the popular sectors, meaning the working-class neighborhoods waiting for the bus from work to get back to home, were telling me that they like Obama. And I would ask them why, and they said, he speaks Spanish.
Interesting. Carol, hold it right there. I'm going to get a final question from Joe Trippi. Joe, we just have a few seconds. What is the significance of the Puerto Rico primary come November, do you think?
Well, it'll have no significance come November.
No significance come November. Joe Trippi, political consultant. Thanks. Music, big part of Puerto Rican culture. Here's a song that was released back in February in support of the Obama campaign by a Latino media group in the U.S.
Obama, Obama, dicen que no quinta marcha y ahora vamos a votar. Presentó mi gente, es tiempo para algo diferente. What we need es un nuevo presidente. ¿Cómo se dice? ¿Cómo se llama? Obama.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Words that tripped you up. Spelling, pronunciation, all the stories. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. It's your conversation. Joining us for the rest of the hour is Krista Freeland, who's managing editor of the Financial Times. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
We've got some economic news in about 10 minutes, which we're going to talk about. We also have like oil bubble bursting. Oil's down like $5 a barrel. That's pretty interesting. You'll have more to say about that at the next part of the hour, right?
Absolutely.
But sit tight with us. And what? Go ahead.
Is it going to hit 200?
Is it going to hit 200?
The Goldman analyst.
Yeah, well, we will, that's some drama to set up for the next segment. But we're going to turn the page here. One of South America's few remaining uncontacted indigenous tribes has been spotted and photographed on the border between Brazil and Peru. The Brazilian government says it took the images to prove the tribe exists and to help protect its land. And the pictures are amazing. You actually can see them on television and on our website. The photos show tribe members outside thatched huts surrounding by dense jungle, pointing bows and arrows up at the camera. Miriam Ross is from Survival International, a campaign group which supports tribal people around the world, fights to get their land protected, and says that logging is threatening these groups' existence in Peru. Miriam, what's the significance of these pictures?
Well, these pictures are really unique. They're the only pictures that show an existence of this particular tribe. They're amazing, obviously. We have people pointing arrows at the camera in a very clear message saying, leave us alone, we don't want contact with the outside world. And like uncontacted tribes all around the world, these people are under threat from, around the world, people are under threat from many things, illegal logging, mining, oil companies, sometimes fundamentalist missionaries, and they're giving a very clear message saying we don't want to be contacted, leave us alone on our land.
Well, Miriam, there's a dilemma there that I wonder if you could explain. I mean, if there is a warning that needs to be delivered to them and they are facing stresses in the face of deforestation, et cetera, they need to be warned, perhaps they need to be shown, go over here, not over here. What are the risks of contacting a tribe like this, even to warn them how to be safe?
Well, what really needs to happen for these tribes to be protected is that their land rights are respected. Tribal peoples own their land under international law. The Brazilian government recognizes this and maps out indigenous peoples' lands, even where the tribes aren't uncontacted. But it does this without contacting them, so that they can continue to live their way of life on their land.
Because, Miriam, contact can be fatal, right?
It can be absolutely catastrophic. I mean, it's not unusual at all for 50% or more of a tribe to die, a tribe like this tribe, to die after first contact.
Because of what?
Sometimes because of violence, more often because of disease, because isolated people have very little immunity to diseases like malaria, flu, even the common cold, which are, commonplace to us, but just can just wipe them out completely.
Now, the Brazilian government, I guess I wonder, what is their position here? I mean, they've not necessarily always been the friend of indigenous tribes or the foe of massive deforestation.
Well, no, quite. This is the Indian Affairs Department in the Brazilian government, and the people who took the photographs are incredibly committed to protecting these people. And that's not to say that there's not many problems going on in other parts of Brazil, including with uncontacted tribes. But in this particular area on the Brazil-Peru border, it's really illegal logging on the Peruvian side which is causing the problem. So part of the reason for these photos being taken was the hope that the interest generated would persuade the Peruvian government to sort out the problem and to actually acknowledge that these people exist.
Miriam Ross, the border creating some of the instability and the tribe is caught in the balance. Survival International, that's where Miriam is from, a campaign group which supports tribal people around the world and fights to get their land protected and says logging is threatening these groups' existence in Peru. That's a pretty interesting story. In Brazil, Krista Freeland, who's managing editor of the Financial Times, is one of the big growth economies.
The Brazilian economy is really on the boil right now. Mm. Two rating agencies have upgraded it now.
Well, we're 5 minutes away from some economic figures. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But it's time for headlines with Femi Okeh.
Hello there. 26 minutes past the hour. Texas Supreme Court rules polygamous sex children should be returned to their parents. U.S. authorities are investigating whether Chinese officials secretly copied the contents of a Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez and then used the information to try to hack into the department's computers. This happened in December, but Gutierrez says he's not discussing the matter during the investigation. Myanmar's ruling junta is complaining that the international community isn't being generous enough with money for cyclone relief. Aid agencies accuse the reclusive government of continuing to hinder access to the disaster area. And in sports, the LA Lakers are moving on to the NBA Finals after they beat the San Antonio Spurs last night. The Lakers are going to play either Boston or Detroit, and that series continues tonight in Detroit with Boston leading 3-2. And finally, Diane O'Dell defied medical odds by living almost 60 years in an iron lung. She contracted polio as a child and needed the machine to keep her breathing. This week, Diane died when a power outage shut down her iron lung and the emergency generator failed to start. But it did raise a question here on The Takeaway about how many people live in an iron lung. It seems to be a throwback to the 1950s. To help us with some of our questions, we're going to Richard Daggett. He's the president of the Polio Survivors Association. And Richard, you've actually lived in an iron lung. What was it like?
Yes, I contracted polio when I was 13, and within 24 hours I couldn't move at all and I couldn't breathe, so they put me in an iron lung. And it's an iron lung is a very gentle way to assist your breathing. It mimics the mechanics of human breathing very well, so it's not uncomfortable.
I'm just going to explain to our audience.
And it keeps you alive. The only physical contact with the machine is a collar around your neck that helps.
Richard, I'm just going to explain to you. I'm just going to explain to our audience at home why you're pausing, or perhaps you can explain that.
Well, I still use a respirator, a different kind. I can only breathe I can only talk when the respirator allows it.
So he's breathing out when he talks, and then the machine is helping him breathe in again.
That's right. And Richard, tell us how many people are still living using iron lungs here in the United States, and why would they still be using such old-fashioned technology?
Well, we believe about 30.
30 people?
No real list. But we believe about 30 people, and as I said, it's very comfortable, and their life depends on it. So,
and what's the alternative? Because I know now that you've got a tracheotomy, so that's an alternative, but you don't have to lie in a 7-foot tube anymore, Richard, do you?
No, there's very, very many alternatives to iron lungs, and most people have done that, but it's a choice, and when your life depends on something, sometimes you hesitate to change to a technology that you're not familiar with.
There's a lot at stake. That's a great story, Femi.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah, indeed.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're talking about the economy with Krista Freeland, who's the managing editor of the Financial Times. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Before we do that, though, I want to we've had some great responses to our takeaway question, which is, what are words that trip you up in some way, spelling or otherwise? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Andrea here in New York says, when I was a senior in high school, I used the word horrific in a term paper. When the paper was returned to me, the word horrific was circled in red, and the note next to it said, not a word, because I found the word in a text that I did not cite in my footnotes. I was afraid to bring it to the attention of the teacher and just let the matter drop. Since then, whenever I hear the word horrific, mostly on NPR, I wonder what that's about, I smile to myself, grit my teeth, and think about my teacher, Mr. Maxwell, from North Farmington High School in Michigan. That's from Andrea in New York. Horrific tripped her up. Well, you know.
Or trip Mr. Maxwell up.
There you go. Definitely trip Mr. Maxwell up. All right. So we've got average April personal savings rate unchanged at 0.7%, consumer spending up 0.2%, and incomes up 0.2%. Those are slow numbers for spending and personal saving. Krista, what are the significance of those numbers, do you think?
Well, the U.S. consumer is such a key to what's going to happen to the U.S. economy. It's really remarkable the extent to which U.S. GDP is based on consumption. It's more than 70% of GDP is about consumption. So the big calculation right now, as we try to figure out how much of a slowdown will there be, will the economy tip into recession, is going to be consumer behavior. And there are really two schools of thought. You know, one school is, look, the U.S. consumer has finally hit the barriers. The Americans have not been saving. The domestic balance sheet, as it were, is in the red. And maybe this is a moment with people no longer being able to use their house as an ATM, take out home equity loans.
Right. Debt cash as the spending driver.
Maybe we're going to start seeing people pulling back, the savings rate increasing. And in the medium to long term, that would be good, but would be really, really rough for the economy. The other school of thought says that American consumers just are going to spend and that a lot of people have lost a lot of money betting against Americans going shopping.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that strategy. I mean, if you're talking about an economy that's changing from a kind of finance your spending and, you know, devil may care about the future to a pay-as-you-go strategy where people are actually making more intelligent choices about their spending based on the cash they have on hand, is that likely to be reflected in numbers that show a serious downturn in spending, or is it going to shift to numbers like these where there's tiny little incremental growth rates that don't really constitute a big trend, but we're basically going to reach a kind of a plateau where it's a little, you know, tenth of a percentage point here, tenth of a percentage point there?
Well, you know, John, I think that this is the central question. And if we were looking for a Goldilocks scenario, a scenario of the softest, most pleasant readjustment of the U.S. economy, what we would hope for, I think, is that the retrenchment of the family budget, of family spending patterns, would definitely be moving towards a higher savings rate, but that wouldn't happen all of a sudden, that it would happen slowly. And in fact, of course, the fiscal stimulus, those checks that a lot of people are getting, are about trying to prompt the opposite behavior. And they have been calculated to be targeted at those people with the greatest marginal propensity to consume, the people who are unlikely to save that money or use it to pay off debt, but who the government, Hank Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, is crossing his fingers, they will go out and buy stuff with it.
Let's talk about oil for a moment. We've seen oil go from $135 a barrel to a down into the 20s. Is a bubble bursting here? Is this something that is important for fuel-consuming consumers here in the United States? Or is this a speculative bubble burst that actually has more to do with pension funds and other people who are investing in commodities?
Well, I think, John, if you and I knew exactly what was going to happen to the price of oil,
we
should
be
leave your
at a radio
studio
station.
We should run our own commodities hedge funds.
That's right. I think we should do that, yeah.
But I think that we can talk about some of the factors. And I think the price of oil is really interesting and complicated right now because there are two sort of countervailing forces going on. One is definitely structurally, it is undeniable that there are some solid reasons on the demand side for
China,
the price,
India, Brazil.
Poor people getting richer.
Right.
And the oil that exists in the world has become more expensive for producers to produce. So those are two really big reasons why it's pretty easy to justify a longer-term higher price of oil.
But having demand said that, is starting to fall in the industrialized world, and particularly in the United States, so...
Exactly. And that's one of the calculations that the Fed is making. And there is also a financial component to the higher price of oil. Something people are starting to focus on, which I think is really interesting, is that in recent years, and actually particularly since last summer, we've seen some of the big pension funds, some of these investors of big pools of money, diversifying into commodities.
And it used to be that stock funds would diversify by getting into bonds, but now with the dollar kind of plummeting, it's actually safer and smarter to get into commodities.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we saw over the summer, last summer, was suddenly financial markets were looking very shaky, very volatile, very hard to predict, and you had a flight to quality, and commodities felt like a really good, safe, quality investment.
And the last thing you'd ever imagine 10 years ago is that someone would say, commodities are a flight to quality. That was the place.
Safety.
And to
exactly.
Safety, right. That's the place where you lose the big bucks. That's the high-stakes poker table, commodities. But in this environment, it's a safe bet for some financial institutions.
Right. And actually, it has another benefit, which is that it diversifies your portfolio very effectively. And what we've seen happening is as stocks are falling, commodities have been rising.
All right. Well, more talk about the economy in a moment. But first, we're going to go to Femi Oke with some more headlines.
It's 21 minutes to the hour. Tuesday marks the final Democratic presidential primaries, and both candidates are out on the stump. Hillary Clinton heads back to Puerto Rico. Barack Obama is in Montana, and John McCain campaigns in Wisconsin. Top party leaders want uncommitted delegates to make up their minds quickly after Tuesday's votes. The Army says that at least 115 soldiers committed suicide in 2007, and that's the highest rate on record. Texas child welfare officials say they will comply with the state Supreme Court and return children taken from a polygamous compound to their parents. The ruling says that welfare officers overstepped their authority. Our soaring gas prices, partly the result of market manipulation. The Federal Commodity Futures Trading Commission says it started a wide-ranging probe in December to investigate potential abuses in the way crude oil is purchased, shipped, stored, and traded nationwide. Krista is nodding. They can't hear you nod on the radio, Krista. You agree there, I can see. One more story. And finally, a comedy icon has passed away.
I've decided to launch an attack that will reduce Rock Ridge to ashes. I want you to round up every vicious criminal and gunslinger in the
That was Harvey Korman, who was playing one of the most famous characters, Hedley Lamarr, from the film Blazing Saddles.
My mother will be so sad. Oh. She was such a big Harvey Korman fan. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
We're going to get to Sex and the City in a minute and weekend movies, but we want your 30-second reviews, okay? Leave them at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll play them on Monday.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Words that trip you up. Well, I found mine already in this program. John, you rock, says Anne, but you mispronounced the LIBOR rate. I was saying LIBOR. It's the LIBOR rate. Thanks, Krista. You could have helped me out with that there.
I didn't want to embarrass you.
You didn't want to embarrass me. Well, now I'm even more embarrassed. Krista Freeland is managing editor of the Financial Times. She's with us. And, of course, it's Friday. It's movie day. There are movies coming this weekend. We want you to go see them. We want you to review them for us. But we're going to review the big movies this weekend. And, of course, because we are a public service program and we don't want you to have to wade through all of the trailers that are out there, we present you the mashed-up Mother of all trailers.
After years of living in the city, I assumed that if my friends and I ever got our fairy tale endings, that would be the end of the story. But real life always has a twist.
There's someone out there.
Life doesn't always turn out to be your fantasy. Cinderella and the prince lived happily ever after.
That, of course, is Sex and the City, the big movie being released this week, meeting, literally, the strangers, which is also being released. It's a Liv Tyler, Scott Speedman movie. It's a romantic getaway that turns into a violent horror nightmare. Couldn't be more different than Sex and the City. Joining us now is Georgette Blau, owner of On Location Tours, the company that gives Sex and the City bus tours here in New York City. That's got to be a pretty successful business these days.
Oh, yes. We're very, very busy nowadays.
So I suspect the bar is pretty high. You've seen Sex and the City. If you run the Sex and the City tours, if they get anything wrong, you're going to find it. What did you think of the movie?
Oh, absolutely. I love the movie, actually. I was nervous initially about the transition from the television series to movie, and I thought it was great.
Now, what would the issue be with the transition? That they would want to put special effects in, you know, shoes that like have rays that come out of them or something, or giant lizards? What do you think was the transition problem?
You know, I just thought movie going to TV or TV show going into movie normally doesn't make a good transition, but this was great.
How many times have you seen Sex and the City?
I promise you I only saw the movie once, but as far as the series or
this weekend, are you likely to see The Stranger, for instance, or would you probably go to Sex and the City again if you were going to see another movie?
Yeah, probably just going to see Sex and the City again.
Krista, are you a fan of the series Sex and the City?
I would say I'm ambivalent. Love the fantasy, hate some of the stereotypes.
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of that way. We have kids, four kids, and I, you know, the kids in the city is sort of our life, and it sometimes doesn't mix with Sex in the City, but you might actually go see.
I understand that.
We don't need to discuss that anymore.
No.
But you might see the movie, right?
Maybe eventually once I've done all the cartoons, but I have to say the timing could be really good. The classic economist thought is that in a recession, lipstick, cigarettes, and liquor do really well. So maybe it's a good moment for us to watch an indulgent kind of film.
And your business is thriving, the on-location Sex and the City tours, right?
Yes, we do all kinds of movie tours, but this the Sex and the City tour right now is very, very busy.
All right, well, that's a rave, a two thumbs up or a two buses up from
Georgette. No, two Cosmo glasses up.
Two Cosmo glasses up.
Two Manolos up.
From Georgette Blau, owner of the on-location tours, the company that gives the Sex and the City bus tours. And that's your movies for this week.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. We're here with Krista Freeland, managing editor of the Financial Times, talking about the economy and also talking about words that tripped you up. Spelling-wise, we're going to be talking about the National Spelling Bee here in a moment. And our producer, Noel King, talked about being messed up on the word impune when she was 12 years old. Larry Furman from New Jersey writes and says, words that shook me up, changed my life. There are so many. Stock market, irrational exuberance. You love that one. It's only money. But the words that really changed my life, says Larry, I do, followed by I'm pregnant. In a good way, he says.
Yeah, right. We believe you, Larry.
Larry.
He said the in the good way part because his wife listens too, I bet.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see. But Larry, you know, we love that candor. Send it to 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now, headlines from Femi, okay.
Okay, full disclosure. I am from South London, so there's certain words that I have trouble with, like nuclear, like our president. But there was a little one that the producers picked up a little earlier when you were talking to Joe Trippi.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We've cast you generously as prescient because of these fundraisers.
Oh, prescient. I blew it
prescient.
Again.
Don't prescient. Don't we think it is? That prescient. Would be my
I'm in flames today. And thank you for that, Femi. Any other news,
do you know
perhaps?
What? You can stop me 20 times in a newscast. So I know I'm not the person to be pointing fingers, but just thought I'd share that because we talk about words
thank
today.
You. Yes.
What's
news,
the
please.
Time now? Oh, 11 minutes to the hour. this story just come in. It's a New York story. A crane has collapsed on Manhattan's Upper East Side. The fire department said that it's pulled out people out of the wreckage. We'll get you more information before the top of the hour if we're able to. The reason we mention this is because back in March, a crane collapsed in Midtown Manhattan near the United Nations, and that killed 7 people. So more before the top of the hour if we're able to get you that information.
I'm looking at those pictures. It's at the 91st Street and 1st Avenue on the Upper East Side.
Yeah, we'll keep you informed in the next couple of minutes before the end of the takeaway. The UN says Myanmar's military government is removing cyclone victims from refugee camps and dumping them near their devastated villages with virtually no aid supplies. And we have another day, another penny. Gas prices reach an average of 3.96 cents today, so close to $4 a gallon. And that's a new record. And finally, Afghanistan plans to ask international donors for $4 billion next month to revive its agriculture sector. It wants to start using agriculture rather than selling opium, I should say. Oh, my goodness. There you go. I told you I'd mispronounce
Thank
more.
Thank you.
But you know what I'm saying.
Thank
it you, means you don't say opium that often.
I never have need to. Thanks, Krista.
In the battle between words and us, the words seem to be winning. Now to spelling. The National Spelling Bee is ongoing, which reminded us of this movie, Akilah and the Bee.
Ever since you found out there was the National Spelling Bee, you've seen yourself holding up that trophy. But if you can't say it, you can't win it. So say it.
I want to win.
You want to win what?
I want to win the National Spelling Bee!
Yes!
It's that time again. The 81st competition of the Scripps National Spelling Bee concludes tonight. That is a clip from Lawrence Fishburne and Kiki Palmer in the 2006 Akilah and the Bee movie. But here at the Scripps National Spelling Bee, which takes place down in Washington, D.C., more than 280 competitors from America to South Korea are competing to spell words you've never heard of and some you have. But how do the spellers prepare? We welcome now the mother and coach of this year's Bee's youngest contestant, Rupa Hathwar is the mother, okay, of the contestant. First of all, Rupa, thank you for joining us.
Hello, thank you for having us.
Rupa, your 8-year-old son, Shriram, is in the competition. How did he do?
Well, he couldn't get past. He got his second word, the round two test, right, but he couldn't get enough points in his written test, so that's why he couldn't advance past the preliminaries.
What was the word that screwed him up, or that messed him up?
Well, there were in the written test, there were actually 25 words, and there were a few words that he had to spell, and one of them was Pyrrhic, P-Y-R-R-H-I-C.
Oh, Pyrrhic, like Pyrrhic victory. Oh, mm-hmm. That's a tough one. There's a lot of, you need to buy a vowel in that word, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Well, Rupa, what is it like to coach your son in English when English, I suspect, is not your first language?
Well, yes, definitely it's tough, but we do have help from different sources, and including the audio pronunciation websites and software. So, yeah, I try to use most of the time.
But Shriram's doing okay, right? He's not going to be scarred for life because of this, right?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, 5 minutes later, he's like a typical boy jumping around and running. He had mentioned before that it's okay if you get a word wrong. He's not going to be devastated. And just he's come here just for the fun of it. So spelling is the only one of the few things that he does in life. And he's lot many other interests. So.
Well, Rupa and her son live in Pointed Post, New York, and I suspect you'll be heading back there after the weekend. More about the spelling bee in a moment. But also joining us is Maria Mariani. Maria, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you.
So, Maria, you helped to develop spell check with IBM back in the 1970s, right?
That's correct.
Now, if spell check works the way I suspect you envisioned it, there may not be spelling bees 100 years from now. True or false?
Oh, no, that's false. The spelling bee will always be around, and if you're a reader, a good reader, you'll be a good speller. And spell check is just an aid, and it really is a typing aid, and that's really what it's all about.
Now, would it ever be possible to put, like, spell check in a cell phone, which you could smuggle into a spelling bee, and it'd be kind of like the steroid controversy where...
Yeah, I think so. Right now, the kids are using, messaging and texting, And when you text, you get the ability to check a word and check the spelling of a word, or it will give you options for a word. So, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think it could happen right now.
Are you a bad speller?
I'm a great speller.
You're a great speller, mm-hmm. and you developed spell check.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, now I wouldn't have thought that.
Well, you know, it was a group of linguists from Georgetown, and I happened to be one of them, from Georgetown University.
Rupa, do you use spell check on your computer?
Yes, I do sometimes, but I try to. I consider myself as somewhat of a good speller too. So yes, but I do like to still use spell check sometimes.
Is it possible to know what the most misspelled word is based on some sort of statistical analysis of spell check, Maria?
I'm sure there's a way to figure it out. You know, yes, I would say so.
But you can't speculate.
No.
I mean, what is the...
I'm sure there are people who have done studies on it. I'm sure that, you know, if you went online and said, you know, the most frequently, you know, misspelled word, it would probably pop up. Somebody has probably figured it out with the program.
So, Rupa, is Shriram going to try next year to be in the spelling bee?
Well, he doesn't want to keep doing it. That's what he said a couple of days ago. So I guess we will be seeing him.
Well, you know, there's plenty of time to convince him that maybe he ought to give it another shot, right?
Oh, yes. It's obviously totally up to him to decide what he wants to do, and we are there to support his wishes, so we'll see what happens.
I'm a famously bad speller myself. Maria, have you ever done a spelling bee?
I have, yes.
Really?
In grammar school.
And how'd you do?
I made it to the end. Didn't win, but, you know.
What was the word? What was the word?
I can't remember what the word was, to tell you the truth.
You blocked it out?
Yeah, probably.
It was pretty traumatic for you.
Yeah. I don't know that it was traumatic, but, yeah, I was disappointed.
Thank you. Maria Mariani, who helped to develop spell check with IBM in the 70s. And Rupa Hathwar, mother of 8-year-old Shriram Hathwar, the youngest contestant at the Scripps National Spelling Bee. They live in Pointed Post, New York. But what word were you tripped up on? Here's an answer.
Hi, this is Edie from Greenwich Village in New York. And the word that tripped me up is vermilion. But what I used to say, vermiloin. And since my dad owned a paint store, it was a real family joke that Edie would say vermiloin.
Hi, this is Doug from Truro. And my trip up word was, has always been, well, was anchovies. For the longest time, I thought anchovies were a vegetable.
Oh, that's great. Here's another one. Tom Jones, you'll love this one, Krista. Trying to impress his Japanese girlfriend who was putting on big shoes, he tried to say kutsu, which is a Japanese word for big shoes. Instead, he said ketsu, which means big butt. Big problem there. Anyway, thanks for joining us.
Very classic guy problem.
In honor of your presence here on the show, we have a little sort of audio. That's the closing bell, and we're closing it out for today. Thanks for being with us.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
Sure. Any word that trips you up?
My most humiliating headline as an editor was we confused rain as in John reigns supreme over the airwaves with rain as in John holds the reins of power.
Okay,
that was a bad one.
Thanks for being with us here and closing us down. Keep your responses coming to anything you heard on today's show. My co-host, Adora Udoji, will be back on Monday. Of course, she's on assignment today. Making tough choices on where to go to school based on financial aid, still paying off loans after you graduated. We want your stories for Monday's show, and you can send them to us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE, and we'll play some of your stories on the air. We have new video, and the mashup movie Mother of All trailer is on our website. See you Monday.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.